Welcome to What is Going Om for New Thought from the Edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgebeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgebeer.
Hello, Sandy.
Mindfulness and meditation are practiced by millions of people around the world, and their benefits are being hailed by everyone, from neuroscientists, doctors, and mental health professionals to parents and teachers. The popularity of mindfulness programs has exploded. They're now being offered in schools and prisons, in workplaces and homes, because of course everybody knows it can transform our lives and make us happier, calmer and better people. Or so it's claimed. According to today's guest, there's a darker side to meditation and mindfulness that few people talk about. For meditation and mindfulness can also have a negative impact. Dr. Miguel Farias is an experimental psychologist and founding director of the Brain Belief and Behaviour Lab at Britain's Coventry University. The lead editor of the Oxford Handbook of Meditation, Dr. Farias is the co-author, along with Dr. Catherine Wickholm, of the groundbreaking book, The Buddha Pill, Can Meditation Change You?, which set both the media and academic worlds alight when the first edition was published in 2015. Now updated with the latest research, Dr. Farias joins me now to discuss all of his research on meditation and the science behind it, as well as some of the questions raised in his book about the myths and the limitations of meditation and mindfulness. Dr. Miguel Farias, welcome.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here with you, Sandy.
Dr. Farias, The Buddha Pill, it's a provocative title, which of course, given the stir it created, I imagine was your intention in choosing it. But what inspired you to write the book in the first place?
What actually inspired me and Catherine was a piece of work we were doing looking at the effects of yoga and meditation across British prisons. So we were working alongside a charity that organizes yoga and meditation classes in the UK, and we conducted a trial to see whether people who were doing the yoga and meditation for 10 weeks were better off in terms of their mental health, their levels of well-being, if their stress levels would be reduced and their positive effects would be increased after the 10 weeks of yoga and meditation. So that was really the kicking off point for this book. It was that piece of research in prisons.
Why did you pick people in prisons in particular?
Well, as it happens in life, I just met at a dinner party the director of this organization that has been, for the past 20 years, organizing these yoga and meditation classes. And this organization had been led also by a Benedictine nun, a Canadian Benedictine Catholic nun, who was also a master in Zen Buddhism. So there was a lot of interesting history about this organization. And the director told me that what they were aiming to do was radically transform the prisoners by getting them to do yoga and meditation and have a deep experience of how there was a deep spiritual experience, I suppose, in which they would feel that there really is no substantial difference between themselves and everyone else.
So you are a meditator, and so is Dr. Catherine Wickholm, your co-author. What led you to start investigating, you know, whether there was a dark side? I mean, what even made you think about that?
So this is a story which I like to tell when I give lectures on our book. In our book proposal, we didn't think of writing the chapter which became The Dark Side of Meditation. it so happened that I was giving a course in Oxford on the psychology of spirituality. And one of my students, someone who had been doing yoga and meditation for a while, she herself had been a yoga teacher for over 20 years. One day she was doing a weekend meditation retreat and started feeling unwell. The meditation teacher told her to just keep on meditating, that it would be fine. But she only kept feeling, she kept feeling worse and worse. And eventually she had a massive psychotic episode where she started hallucinating. She felt that herself and her body were occupying different spaces. And this eventually led afterwards to a deep depression episode. And it took her about 10 years to come out of that. So I was astonished to hear this story, but it was really the trigger to get me and Catherine to look at the scientific literature on the adverse effects of meditation. And suddenly, lo and behold, there it was, going back to the mid-70s, some of our psychology colleagues and psychiatrists had been writing about the potential negative effects of meditation.
Wow, so how come the public didn't really know about that? Because this morning I Googled statistics on meditation and, you know, thousands upon thousands of pages emerged, and all of the top pages that I went through at the beginning were all singing the praises. I mean, the things that they say about meditation, the research that apparently has been done, the studies that have shown all kinds of things, you know, people looking younger, insomnia going away, stress relief, but also things like thickness of the artery walls decreasing, lowering the effects of or the risk of heart attack and stroke by up to 15%. So why is it that the less positive side, the research, hasn't been publicized?
That's a very, very good question. And what we're trying to do is provoke people to think about what's going on. How come we have started thinking about something which 40 years ago, it was a marginal thing. If 40 years ago, as a psychologist, I would want to do research on meditation, I would probably be thrown out of my university, right?
Yeah.
Because this was something associated with Orientalism and superstition. So something has changed radically since then. And part of the story in our book is looking at how our understanding of meditation has really changed radically since the late 60s. And one of the major reasons is because there has been so much science in it. But let me go back to the dark side. So there has been a sort of fabrication, of marketing of meditation, about the same time that we stumbled upon the ideas and the literature on these adverse effects. An American academic who is also a Buddhist priest, Ron Purser, had written a newspaper article called MacMindfulness, where he pointed out that these meditation techniques coming from a Buddhist tradition had turned into sort of fast food meditation without any ethics behind it. And one of the potential downsides to it, he suggested, was that you could have a mindful sniper. So someone who's holding a gun and shooting another person who's completely mindful of what he or she are doing, right? And this is perfectly plausible because meditation has been stripped of its ethical and moral content. It's only about being present in the moment in a non-judgmental way, as secular mindfulness is supposed to be, then it's conceivable that it can be used for negative ends, right? So this also led us to look at how this shows up in history. And another U.S. academic who's a historian of Buddhism and himself a Zen Buddhist priest, he has published a couple of books looking at the uses of meditation techniques during the Second World War to sort of brainwash or depersonalize Japanese soldiers to think that their own selves don't really matter, so that they can go on and be killed without worrying about being killed. So as we dug deeper and deeper into this, we realized that there's a literature that goes into different ways. On the mental health side, there's been, as I said, a literature that goes back to the mid-1970s. Surprisingly, so if you go back to the 1970s, you may remember that this was a time when there was an explosion of cognitive behavior therapy.
Yeah.
So the idea that you can increase your well-being by changing how you think about your feelings and your emotions and your thoughts. So key people in the cognitive behavior movement, like Albert Ellis or Arnold Lazarus, they were some of the people who wrote articles suggesting that some of their own patients had put themselves into a difficult situation by meditating. And this happens in different things. They claim that some of them got more depressed, others had some grandiose ideas how meditation made them somewhat superhuman-like. Now, when we look at the whole range of psychological literature on the potential negative effects, what you mostly get are people who become more stressed or anxious or also depressed. Now, there is a bright side to this. What this is telling us is that meditation is not for everyone, right? Part of the marketing of meditation has been that this is universally good for everyone. However, what throughout the centuries we have known is that most people within these religious traditions don't do meditation. Actually, this has been reserved for a very small elite of people. So, for instance, when you look at Buddhist traditions, you find a surprising variety of meditation techniques, right? And you also find very clear specifications that you have to be careful when using certain techniques because this can lead to, for example, to physical negative manifestations such as tremors, physical tremors, or restlessness, or lack of sleep, or agitation, or even some symptoms which today we'd call psychosis. So this wasn't written 10 or 20 years ago. It was written centuries ago by people who were part of this elite of religious meditators. So it's not something which has only been happening within the last 40 years or so. We have known about this. Equally, in the Christian tradition, there are mentions of difficulties associated with the meditative or the contemplative path.
You make some good points in the book about, meditation. It is a process, a solitary process in a sense. You can do it in a group, but basically it's a solitary process and you're going within and you're being with yourself and you're dealing right with, you know, whatever comes up. Although obviously, you know, we're taught that the whole idea of it is to just ignore everything that comes up. But certainly in the beginning when people are just starting out with meditation, a lot of stuff comes up. And if they're not equipped to deal with it in some way, I could see how that could become very challenging for people. If they do not have a meditation teacher that they could talk to about it, or someone who can is experienced in some way, if somebody's doing this completely on their own, it could be a rather frightening experience.
Yes, indeed. So we have had, since we've published the book, quite a lot of reports from people who have had somewhat frightening experiences. And often, because the teachers are either not very experienced or aren't aware of the possibility that people might might have difficult experiences, they're usually just told to keep on meditating and it will just go away. And it can be unhelpful, this kind of advice. Now, you've just mentioned something which is quite important, that meditation is usually a solitary experience. So yes and no. So throughout the centuries, it was actually an activity which was most often done alongside other people, right? So the idea of the monks that go into a cave or go into a forest, do this on their own, these are the minority amongst the minority. Most of the time, these religious men and women were meditating with other people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there probably was a very good reason for this. Perhaps if they met some difficult experiences, the others were there to help ground them.
So, okay, yeah. Well, that's often what does not happen these days. I mean, you know, we really can't control it because it is so widespread. And often we may not even know that somebody is engaging in meditation. Or indeed a mindfulness practice, unless they're doing it in a group. You gave some wonderful examples of some of the negative things that can come up. You told the story of the young man, Aaron Alexis, who was studying, wanted to be a Buddhist priest, was studying meditation, going to the temple. He was chanting, doing all kinds of things. And then one day he just turned up the Washington dock or something, and killed 15 people. You also shared the story of the guy who was a drug dealer, a drug lord, and very wealthy one too, who became a yoga instructor. And he said some very interesting things about meditation when you spoke to him. It wasn't that meditation actually made him a better person. He said it really basically strengthened some aspects of him that were already there. He just transformed, you know, where he was focusing his energy.
Yes, that's a wonderful story. In different ways, as you were suggesting. So someone who was a wealthy drug lord and then used yoga and meditation to become a different person. He now runs a very successful yoga studio in Notting Hill, so in London, where he gives classes to very wealthy people. But what's interesting is that he acknowledges too that his personality, his temperament, haven't really changed. He was always a very competitive person, and that's what really helped him to take on yoga and meditation as a challenge and to become really good at this. But he fully confesses that he still feels sometimes the urge to do something illegal, and he uses meditation and yoga to sort of get a hold of himself, to control himself.
Well, now, is that getting hold of himself, or is he using meditation as a displacement activity?
Ah, no. That's a very, very good question indeed.
But it does raise these kinds of questions, doesn't it? I mean, there's some... Yeah. You know, I went through several... I read your book over the period of a week, and I went through several kind of, you know, thoughts and feelings about it. And at first I thought, oh, you're knocking meditation and mindfulness because you're trained, you're a psychologist, et cetera, et cetera. And then I thought, no, that's not what's happening here. But, you know, with each story that you told, it was so revealing. I mean, I, like many people, have believed that, you know, all Buddhists are very peaceful people. Well, that's not actually true, is it? You know, you relate some wonderful conversations you've had with experts, and it revealed some stuff about Buddhism, particularly Zen Buddhism in Japan during the war, Hitler's admiration. I mean, the detachment that, you know, that form of Buddhism actually created in some people made them less kind and perhaps less humane, they could easily justify some terrible things.
Yes, yes. I think the problem, and psychologists are to be blamed for this in part, is that we have come to believe in a very simplistic model of how our mind works, right? So some of my colleagues who do studies on mindfulness, they like to use this muscular metaphor that our minds are like a muscle, and meditation is for the mind like going to the gym for the body. It's a kind of gym,
yes,
for the mind. And I think that's really a pathetic metaphor. If our minds were really like a muscle, then certainly we would have sorted out most of the world's problems by now, wouldn't we?
One would hope so.
Right? If it were that simple, we'd have sorted out problems like greed, which makes us just want to get more stuff and to be wealthier, like basic selfishness, war certainly, and aggression. But we haven't sorted out any of these problems, have we?
No, we haven't.
So it's very, very unlikely that our minds are just like a muscle.
I'm going to go to the break now, but there's plenty more to discuss here. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. My guest today is experimental psychologist and author of the groundbreaking book, The Buddha Pill, Can Meditation Change Us?, which incited much debate in the media and academic circles with its claim that there's a darker side to meditation. We'll be back with more after this break.
The future of internet radio is here. OM Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free. AscendingHearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
I am Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called the Bukavu in the Congo.
We were a loving family. And then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day.
People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle you to America and all your problems are done, they don't understand that that's the beginning of everything.
I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at embracerefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Dr. Miguel Farias, in the 2015 edition of Buddha Pill, you outlined seven myths and facts about meditation and mindfulness, which you've now updated. I'd like to hear about those seven myths and facts, but first, why did they need updating just 3 years later?
All right, Sandy, yes, very good question. What we mean by updating, we didn't include any new myths. And myths here, we don't mean that it's necessarily something false, just that there is a certain belief, and we're questioning to what an extent that belief or idea is correct or not. So we haven't updated that in the sense that we haven't added new ones or changed the ones you had. What we did update was the evidence regarding these different so-called myths around meditation.
Well, let's talk about them. I mean, you've got myth one, meditation never has adverse or negative effects. It will change you for the better and only the better. What's your response to that?
Yeah, so it's very much what we were talking about in the first part of the show. And Something that we mention in the book is a quote from a Swami, so someone who has become a monastic Hindu who has a delightful sense of humor. When we interviewed her, she explained these adverse effects in a very simple way with a cooking metaphor. She said, it's like cooking lentils, you know, the scum rises to the surface when you're cooking lentils, which again gives us an interesting idea about deeper mental processes that are going on. When you really want to find out who you are, then you come upon different chambers, places where you've perhaps never ventured to before. So something that we have added to this myth, because we have done further research, is that actually going back to 1977, the American Psychiatric Association issued a position statement, which is something which they don't do often. It's only when they find that there's something which is growing in popularity, like meditation was back in the 1970s, and they feel they have to say something about this. And back then, this statement already said very clearly that we need to look at the science of this, how useful it can be, how it can be indicated to certain people, but we also have to look at the contraindications and the dangers of meditation. And it's interesting to have dug up this sort of statement from the American Psychiatric Association, because 40 years onwards, it's only now, and in part because of our book, that since 2015, it has become more openly acknowledged by psychologists that do research on mindfulness and meditation, that yes, this can go wrong for some people, and we have to understand who are these people, how often it happens. We have to look carefully into this. So the research on this is still, I mean, very precarious, but it's more acknowledged now than it was when we published the book 4 years ago.
Which also really answers myth two. Meditation can benefit everyone when clearly it can't. You know, maybe it should come, you know, how all recommendations you see in books these days are exercise, you know, consult your doctor first. Well, maybe people should consult somebody before they undertake meditation. I mean, I'm sure that there are questions that can be asked. I know that you certainly would ask a specific question of anyone who came to you and said, should I meditate? And it may not be the question that other people would ask.
Yes. So that's a very, very important point, which is interesting. So we live in a time, and particularly in the US and in the UK, we highly value individualism, right? So we teach our children the importance of autonomy, of individual resilience, of how important it is to follow their dreams. However, on the other hand, it seems that we want recipes that work for everyone. And meditation, like many other things, doesn't work for everyone in the same way, which is why, I mean, there are hundreds of meditations. I mentioned in the first part of our program tonight that this student I had a massive psychotic episode and then a serious depression. Now, the good part of the story that she came out on the other side of the tunnel, and she went back to meditation, and she's now a practicing Buddhist. However, to keep meditating or going back to meditation, she had to find out which meditation technique worked with her that helped her to ground herself instead of going out there and losing herself. And this has led her to develop a beautiful website, which is called Meditating in Safety, where she tells her own story and that of other people who also have difficulties in meditating. Now, hers is an interesting story because it reminds us that not only doesn't benefit everyone, but also that there were a huge variety of meditation techniques. And probably one of the reasons why there are so many meditation techniques is because we are different people and we need different techniques. So even now, in terms of the science of this, we're pushing towards trials on meditation and mindfulness, which attempt to disentangle how different people react differently to meditation techniques, what we call individual differences, which parallels in a certain way or mirrors what is happening with medicine. So we're moving towards individualized or individual tailored medicine. So why shouldn't we have the same with meditation techniques?
Quite. I mean, the technology we have these days, the brain imaging technology, has been responsible for a lot of great information emerging. But again, you know, also some people tend to jump on that information as a positive and only as a positive. I interviewed Daniel Goleman last year, and his book, Altered Traits, was a fascinating book. And he's obviously a great proponent. I interviewed one of the representatives in Congress, Tim Ryan, who is responsible for getting mindfulness in the schools in his district in Ohio, and it's proving to be very, very successful. But you know, you also write about how some children in classes have got very upset, that they find it very distressing and stressful.
Yes, it was actually Catherine, who's a practicing clinical psychologist in the UK, in London. She was seeing a teenager who had a serious anxiety issue, and she told her that she was being forced to do mindfulness in school with 30 other kids in a class, and that she hated every minute of it, and that she felt very, very anxious when she had to do this with all these other kids in class. But because there were all these other kids in class, she felt she couldn't just get up and tell the teacher, I really don't like this, I don't want to do this, because there's all this peer pressure, and she just stand up and be marginalized. So we have to be careful. There has been actually a researcher in Australia who's written a book about using mindfulness in schools and with university students, which is called Safeguarding Mindfulness in School, precisely because she came across very similar effects, that there were very mixed feelings, there were mixed results coming from these children. And what she found astonishing is that the teachers, the meditation teachers, or the school teachers that were taught to meditation, that they hadn't thought of asking the children, how do you feel after doing the mindfulness exercises? Which is really strange, isn't it? It just shows that our mindset is just completely biased to thinking that, oh yeah, you're going to enjoy this.
Well, I think, you know, the question is, if they're saying that, you know, kids are so stressed these days, we should be looking at why kids are so stressed these days. If we look at the educational system, that alone places so much stress on children. You know, getting kids as young as kindergartners to take exams, for example. The you know, the focus always being on academic grades. We don't think about a child's happiness anymore. You know, we don't encourage them to go out and play as much as they used to. So there are so many reasons for kids to be stressful. I don't know that we can solve them just by putting them through a mindfulness class.
So, Sandy, I think you have touched upon a really, really crucial point. And this is where I feel mindfulness in particular as a meditation technique, could be really helpful for children. But the way it's being used, it's actually unhelpful. Now, so potentially this technique could be used to teach the children that you don't need more, right? You don't need to become better and stronger and more resilient. No, this technique is actually helping you to get rid of stuff, not to become more, but to become less, to have less of these feelings, less of these silly thoughts. But no, what is happening is precisely what you're saying, that something like mindfulness is being used to just push the kids even further. How can we use this to make kids more resilient to stress and anxiety and depression? How can we use this to make them cope better with this educational system, which is making them ill, right?
So absolutely.
It's actually helping us to not think about the causes of why our children are getting ill. Perhaps it's actually a good sign that they are, because it's telling us that there is something wrong with our educational system, that we haven't stopped to think about this. Mass education started not long ago, right? I mean, within humanity's time frame, it started just over 100 years ago for very good reasons. Yes?
Yes.
We wanted to raise children out of poverty, wanted to give them better chances. But we have reached a level in which a good idea, I mean, and there are reasons for this, that the educational system, which is supposed to give kids, I mean, good things, it's actually working against them because it's become a straitjacket. It's actually imposing on children something which is disconnecting them from their own creativity, their own ability to express themselves, to be playful. And what for? With the way things are changing, by the time our children get out of university, most of their training, academic training, will be obsolete.
Obsolete, right? Yes, absolutely.
Obsolete.
Yes, yes, yeah. So actually, and then they're going to need all the resilience they can get, because they're going to have to adapt. It's a bit of a double-edged sword, isn't it? I mean, here we are, you know, there is this great explosion in people wanting to know more about themselves, people wanting, you know, to reach for a better them, whatever, and that could be construed as a good thing, you know, an enlightened thing. But at the same time, I think we lost you there. There was a little gap.
Oh, yeah.
Would you say that again? I think we heard up to he's 12 years old.
Yes. So he's in year 7. And when the clock changes here into the winter hour, things are very bleak, right? So if you have already the image of England as being grey, imagine that there is no sunlight after 3:30.
Yeah.
Kids wake up, it's dark. By the time they're finishing school, it's getting dark. So what does the school do? The school has to fulfill this parental target, which children have to be there 97% of the time, right? Overall. So 97% of the time. So the school gives letters to parents regularly, not just these times, throughout winter. And it's triggering our wonderful ability as parents to feel guilty. The letter said, we appreciate that it's cold and it's dark and it's difficult to get out of bed. However, we have to teach our children grit and determination and resilience, because they can't just not show up at the right time at classes. And I think, so what are you trying to tell us? So you're trying to tell as parents that we should encourage our kids to always show on time, because this is teaching them how to be resilient and to be determined. And good. But it's really nonsense, isn't it? Right? Why can't we just think about this in a different way? Why do we have... Actually, why don't we just think, why do children have to be there at 8 in the morning on a cold winter day, right?
Well, you're raising all kinds of issues now that probably digress a little, but, you know, one of them that Daniel, Dr. Daniel Siegel's book on, I've forgotten what it's called, I'll think of it in a minute, but he talks about the teenage brain. You know, we make our teenagers get up at exactly the same time, but the teenage brain, he says, is designed to be a bit different. There's a reason why suddenly when kids become teenagers, they want to sleep in the morning. You know, their whole body clock, their brains, everything changes. We do not adapt to what our children need. We force them, you know, to conform.
So going back to mindfulness, my problem with mindfulness in schools is that it's not being used in the best of ways. I would like it to be used for children, not just to be better at exams, to deal better with their exam stress, but to actually have a chance to find out better about themselves, to find out who they are, and to have more mental space to actually find out where they want to go, where their heart lies, not just in this utilitarian neoliberal way. Oh yes, let's use this to make you even more productive.
So with all the research that you've done, and I know you've done a lot of meta research as well, and you found you highlight a number of anomalies, you know, the research isn't always quite as good as we think it is. But with all the research that you've done and throwing the cat amongst the pigeons, as it were, when you published the book in 2015 and starting a dialogue that needs to be had, what changes have you noticed, if any?
So I think that my colleagues who work on the science of mindfulness, I mean, have to a certain point acknowledge that we need to look more critically at this, that there's been this huge hype about mindfulness, and we have to mind this. It's intellectually and morally dishonest of us as scientists to be saying that this is great for everyone. This is going to change us and it's going to change the world just like that. We don't work in that way, in that simplistic way. Humans do not work like that. So something, a piece of research which we did was looking at all these really interesting studies which try to show that by meditating, whether doing mindfulness or compassion, loving kindness, meditation, that we become better people, meaning we become more empathic, more compassionate, less aggressive, less prejudiced. So we did a meta-analysis, which means we basically put together all these studies and crunched them to see how powerful the effects are. And again, what we find is that the quality of the studies vary, and the effects are not as powerful as individual studies show. And there's also all sorts of biases. Why? Well, one of the reasons is very simple. Because when I do a study which takes 2 years of my time, I just want the study to work. And even without wanting so, I introduce biases into my research. So one of the things that we found out with these studies that try to make people more compassionate is that you only make people more compassionate in the studies where the meditation teacher is also a co-author in the published study. So this suggests that there are what we call experimenter biases or effects going
on. Yes.
And so quite a lot of my colleagues have taken this seriously. And I've received, for instance, invitations to collaborate on new studies where we have people who really believe that meditation is going to be beneficial, but they want me to be part of the study because I'm more critical, so that there is a balance also in the people who are undertaking the study. So I think on the whole, there are positive steps. What I'm worried about is that something which is inherently, I mean, rich and interesting and positive, like meditation, if it becomes massified, and then we start realizing that, I mean, negative things start happening to people, that then we just slide back and start saying that, well, actually, this wasn't such a good idea. Let's just find something else. And then we just find something else and forget this. Or it just becomes one more therapeutic technique among 500 more. I think there is also the danger that we're losing what's inherently interesting and rich about meditation. And one of the things is that it allows us not just to find a place of calm. I think more than anything, it's a place where we can find ourselves in a different way, right? Where we can think about ourselves and experience ourselves in a different way from our everyday selves. And that's really, really genuinely interesting. And expressive, creative.
So we need to change our expectations about it. Because what we expect, we're probably going to create. You know, there's a big belief thing going on here, isn't there? If I, you know, I feel guilty about meditation. Everybody I know is meditating. Every time I've tried meditating, I can't, you know, shut my brain off. So I don't really meditate per se. I do my own contemplation. I do my own thinking about things, but I don't meditate to leave my body or gain enlightenment or solve problems in that particular way. But I do feel guilty because everybody else is meditating and I'm not.
a little anecdote that I can share. There was this really well-known psychologist in the 1970s, Charles Sturt, who was one of the pioneering psychologists on altered states of consciousness, right? So there he was with everyone doing New Age and meditation stuff. So he told me once that he was meditating for 15 years and it never did anything for him. But just because every one of his friends was doing it, he felt pressure to do it. Until one day he realized, well, this actually doesn't work for me. So he stopped doing it after 15 years of doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'm sure many people do it for that reason, and I don't discount the benefits. I know so many people who meditate and find it incredibly powerful and useful. But I think you make it very plain in the book. You're not knocking it per se, but we need to be more realistic about it. It is not a panacea. It is not for everyone. And so we're almost out of time now, but what I would like you to do in probably the last minute or so that we have is just tell us, number one, what would you say to people who have been meditating for years and might be feeling a little bit up in arms right now or defensive? And what would you say to somebody who comes to you and says, I would like to meditate?
So the second question, what do I say to someone who would ask me, I would like to meditate? What is it that I do? I think that meditation is like learning how to play an instrument, right? You can learn it on the internet, but if you want to learn it properly, just find a good meditation teacher. And a good meditation teacher would be someone whole, right? Who has a holistic understanding of our mind and of our soul. Who knows that there's blissful states and there are hellish states. I sometimes like to play with the idea of Timothy Leary, who went around the world trying to give LSD to political leaders, thinking that this is only going to work in a blissful way for them. And it doesn't, right?
Yes.
No. So find a good meditation teacher. Find someone who has a holistic understanding of this. Now, with people who have been meditating for a long time, I think most people have been meditating for a long time, have been surprised by their meditation experience. What we know from some studies is that the longer you have been meditating for, the more likely you are to have come across something unpleasant or negative. I mean, just to give one example, once I was in a deep meditation retreat, and I felt this awful anger towards my own father, which completely, surprised me. And, well, because I'm not completely naive in terms of the makeup of my own mind, I could understand where this was coming from. But I was still, if I didn't know, or if I knew less about my own self, I would have been very upset. I might even have gone to my father very angry and thinking, huh, why have you done this to me?
I'm afraid we've run out of time, Dr. Farias. It's been a great conversation. The Buddha Pill, Can Meditation Change You? By Dr. Miguel Farias and Dr. Catherine Wickholm. Absolutely fascinating book. You will learn far more than you can possibly imagine. It's published by Watkins, and you can find out more about Dr. Farias' work at miguelfarias.co.uk. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. Thanks for joining me today, and I look forward to being with you at the same time next week. Till then, it's goodbye from me.